Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program presented by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and San Jose Repertory Theater. My name is Rick Lombardo. It is my pleasure to introduce Louis Gossett, Jr. Mr. Gossett began acting at age 16 and made his film debut with Sidney Poitier in A Raisin in the Sun. He has starred in over 100 films and 60 Broadway and off-Broadway productions, winning numerous awards, including his Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for An Officer and a Gentleman. Offstage, Mr. Gossett is an ardent supporter of the Boys and Girls Clubs of America and was the national spokesman for CARE. He continues to work to end world hunger and poverty among children, and his E-Racism Foundation aims to increase awareness on the issues of racism, ignorance, and societal apathy. As a result of his personal efforts, he has received the NAACP Image Award and the Martin Luther King Humanitarian Award. His memoir, An Actor and a Gentleman, was published this year and is a personal account of his distinguished acting career and lifelong commitment to as many causes and issues that he supports. We're also joined tonight by Brian Copeland, KGO radio host and author of Not a Genuine Black Man. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Louis Gossett, Jr. and Brian Copeland.
I think you got a few fans out here.
Nice. I was here before. I love your town. I love your town.
Well, it is. It's a pleasure to see you in person. We talked on the radio a few weeks ago. I was glad to see how well you're looking. You're looking
first
well.
First time I saw him. I saw him in person. You see his one man show. I highly recommend it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So as I said, you're looking well. You came out earlier this year and disclosed that you had prostate cancer and they caught it in the early stages.
Caught in the early stages, and I highly recommend that you men, when you get past 40 or 50, to go. If you go once a year, you should go two or three times a year, catch things early. I mean, I'm talking about the bathroom. I mean the doctor. You know, but go get it checked out because your family wants you to stick around. You know, and thank God I got there early, and I don't have it anymore. It's gone.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
I was told by the doctors I had to search for proper doctors because, you know, a lot of doctors want the money and they want to string you out, you know, that controversy. So I found some doctors. I found an acupuncture man from Korea. You know, our medicine is 500 years old. Their medicine is 5,000 years old. And so I got some stuff from him and from a young doctor who was working with some of the actresses. What's her name? I can't remember her name now. She passed away, but he extended her life a couple of years. Farrah Fawcett. And he's a young man who knows about the combination of the holistic and the established medicine and the marriage of two. And that's what kind of keeps us on the map. And his other research, and I found he described the meridians, if you know anything about acupuncture. And when a meridian is off, that means there's something wrong with your body. Mm-hmm. So it's in a slow in God's time, I call it. You come better once he puts those needles in your system after a couple of sessions. And he says, let the body take over. And as soon as the body takes over and you get your power back, then you don't have to use any medicine. But I believe that the meridians are true also emotionally and spiritually. When something is off, you kind of need an acupuncture attack somewhere in your spirits and your emotions. And when it all gets aligned, then you're at your best. And I kind of don't hesitate to say that I'm at my best right now at 74 years old. In the combination of spiritual, emotional, and
right
physical.
On. That's wonderful.
Because of that.
And, you know, it was very brave for you to come forward and be so public about this because you wanted to encourage men, especially African-American men, to get tested because I think we talked about this before. Something I didn't know is that, you know, the test you take, the PSA test is what they give you for. And traditionally, or I should say generally, white men get prostate cancer in their 50s, whereas black men get it in their 40s.
Right.
But the insurance companies won't pay for the test for you until you hit 50. So we have to be right.
Sometimes you can't wait that long. You know, you've got to get on with it. But if you find a friendly doctor, keep him. You know, I come from a place where a doctor used to come to my house. But at the time when the doctor didn't come to my house, I had a great-grandmama. And she was a slave, my great-grandmother. And she was responsible from the exodus from the South. I'm dating myself, y'all. So she would come, different people would come from the South to the North during the exodus. And eventually, everybody lived within a 10 or 15, 20 block radius of one another. So the best times, of course, were Thanksgiving and New Year's Eve and Christmas and Easter. Easter was a special church time. I had the shoes, the Tommy Cannon shoes would hurt my feet so bad. But anyway, but it was wonderful. Great, great, great grandmother, Grandma Ray, she, according to the Bible, which started when the slaves were freed in Georgia, her birth was not recorded in the Bible. So she was a slave, maybe 6 or 7 years old. So according to some crude arithmetic, she had to be approximately 112 years old when she passed.
Wow.
She was responsible for all me and my cousins. Well, anybody younger had to have a job. So the men were either porters or chauffeurs or butlers, and the women were, and they were the best. They worked for the rich folks, and the women were the housekeepers. They helped raise everybody.
And the cooks. And the cooks and stuff. Yeah.
And so I got some great foods and stuff. Handmade, no measuring cup with the palm of the hand and the whole thing. And you know the smell of clothes on a line outside, and the sun dries them, and it was a combination of coal and wood-burning stove. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they did not burn biscuits. Fried chicken, all that good stuff.
Now my grandmother, mouth
water, boy.
Now my grandmother came from the South, and yeah. I grew up with a lot of that Southern stuff. You were talking about medicine. Did you have to do the castor oil and all this kind of stuff?
Oh yeah. Well, what's it called?
Sulfur
and molasses.
Yes.
Now
that stuff work?
Y'all here. How many people remember 3 sixes? Uh oh, there you go.
Now what's 3 sixes?
Black draft.
What's 3 sixes? I don't know 3 sixes.
Vile tasting stuff. But if you had something wrong with you, when that hits your system, it's like Raid. It comes out of you. How about acetophenida? So during the time when there was a polio scare or a whooping cough scare, my great grandmother went out in the yard, and she did something, and the smell was sulfurish, tarish. Mm-hmm. Put it around your neck, and said, "Now you can go to school." I went to school, but I was very unpopular. But I was the only one that didn't get sick.
Now, did your grandma ever go out to the outside and grab a switch?
Oh, boy. All right. I want to talk about Grandma now. Grandma Ray and her two friends. She was the mother of the First Baptist Church of Sheepshead Bay. She's about 90 years old by then. And the two deaconesses, one in their 80s, they're sitting in the kitchen. And one lady says, quite serious, she says, "You know, I think I'm getting a little senile. I went to get something out of the refrigerator, and I stood there for 5 minutes trying to remember what I wanted to get out of the refrigerator." The second lady says, "I know what you mean. I stood in my closet for 10 minutes trying to remember what I was going to do standing in there." And my great-grandmother said, she was a very cantankerous lady, she says, "You should be ashamed of yourself talking about how old and senile you're getting." She said, "Look at me. I'm at least 10 years older than both of you. And thank God. Who is it?" That was my great-grandma. She would oversee some 15 of us at one time, and she would not remember our names, but she remembered what we did. And it was a two-story house, and she said, No, it wasn't you. "You go back downstairs and grab a switch off a tree, take the leaves off it, and come back and give it to me." Right, so I was a troublemaker, so I gave it to her, and she never went to school. I wonder how come she knew syllables, because she'd go, "How many times do I have to tell you not that there's only one syllable in have?" She's shut up.
You learned not to talk back.
No.
You did not.
She's
talk
on my shoulder
back.
Today.
You know, when you talk about that kind of an upbringing, as I said, I had a grandma from Birmingham who raised me, and it was the same kind of discipline and tough love. Do you think that, especially young African-American men today, have lost something
by not having the
switches?
Oh, tell me about it. It's not just the switches, but it was the
tough love.
The tough love. Well, now I can take the microphone, and this is why I have the Racism Foundation. And here comes the technician now. More than 5 inches away, huh? All right. Okay, so if you remember, those
we need to push
remember,
the microphone a little bit closer to you. That's it.
Like, this one like this, huh?
There you go.
All right.
There you go.
But if you remember, basically, the neighborhoods of those days, there was no child who was going hungry. If a child was bad, we had before the cell phones, the women in the window.
Mm-hmm.
The old women. I'm going to tell your mama. So I came from a neighborhood which was multi-ethnic in Brooklyn. We were all poor right after the Depression. And poverty is one thing. Hunger is another. We were not hungry. We were poor. It's a big difference. So if my parents didn't get home in time, I had a choice. I could go to the Italian house and get some lasagna. Or you get some gefilte fish. Or you get some corned beef and cabbage. Or some fried chicken. Everybody was at my grandma's house all the time because she could cook. And I think sometimes they told people not to come home because I'm going to go to lose grandma's house because she could cook. But that neighborhood, before school, we were not going to go out the door unless we had some kind of self-respect. We couldn't go out the door unless we dressed properly. Could not go out the door until we had a proper bath or shower.
Mm-hmm.
Our hair was combed, not my hair, but no, hair was combed or teeth were brushed.
Mm-hmm.
Some knowledge of our history and our culture, some kind of spiritual strength. So when we went out the door, there was a protection against what was out there in the streets between our house and the school. And by the time we got to school, we were ladies and gentlemen ready to learn.
All right, so what do you think's happened? Why has it changed?
It's changed because those neighborhoods are broken up a little bit. There's racism still around from the old days. Some of it is unconscious on both sides. We need to move along with the tides, move along with what's happening today. But I hesitate, but I have to say our media is part of the blame.
Really? You think so? And being a part of the media.
Being part of the media is part of the blame, which is why I'm stepping aside a little bit and going to university systems and having this. The media does not portray, this audience does not look like the average movie or television. And it's every lead in every television series and every movie cannot always look like Leonardo DiCaprio. If you know what I'm saying. There's leads here of all kinds. That should be on television and motion pictures.
It looks like America.
So then they're little, they're wonderful movies now. But just our children are paying close attention. They're slaves to television and film. And some of them, most of them, have said, well, we must not have done anything. So they create a subculture. And that's powerful because children are powerful. It goes around the world in hip-hop and rap. But a third of that culture is illegal, and those children, without knowing it, go to prison. But nobody taught them the other thing, so they don't even look over their shoulders.
They don't know any better.
They don't know because nobody was there to teach them.
All right, now you talk about how media and how television and film and culture has a lot to do with this. Is there any role over your long career that you could look at right now and think, you know, I really wish I hadn't done that part? Because that part might have fed into an... And I can't think of anything I've ever seen you in.
I don't think so. I did a small part... But he died. It was in Harry O. I was the guy with the big broad hat during the black exploitation. I had to pay the rent, and I got to play this gang leader. He died. But I don't think anybody had any.
Harry O. That was
Harry
David
O.
Jansen.
That?
David Jansen.
Yeah, that's a good buddy of mine.
Well, I'll tell you, I was looking at your filmography and your TV credits. It's like my childhood. Bonanza, The Rookies.
The Rookies. Yeah.
Love American Style.
Yeah.
The Mod Squad. Do you have a big fro on the Mod Squad?
Oh, yeah, I did a part. Mod Squad, Aaron Spelling, we were friends, you know. And Mod Squad, me and Clarence, CW3, Clarence Williams III, a great actor. Clarence Williams III is a great actor. And how could I point him out to you? He was the beginning of the American Gangster who died. He was Prince's father in Purple Rain.
In Purple Rain, yeah.
He's a great actor. And I met him when he was a young man on Broadway. Early television had its pain, mm-hmm. and it had its joy. Some of the people early television were friends of mine from Broadway. They were the writers, some great writers, Arthur Miller wrote episodic television, and Neil
really?
Simon.
Really? I didn't know he did.
They all wrote episodic. That's how they got up there. Mm-hmm. But they had the awards from theater, and that was the first population in Hollywood. But slowly but surely, it began to change because Hollywood's in the first chapter of the book. It's people in the blue-collar workers. Their parents worked the factories. Then they made the airplanes and the hangars and the army. So and they came from Alabama and Mississippi and Texas. And it's not of their experience for somebody like me who was sent out there in the first chapter.
Let's talk about this in some detail. First, I want to mention the name of the book again, An Actor and a Gentleman.
Yes, in the book.
And you talk about your first the first movie of the week for NBC.
Movie of the week, right?
And you're playing the first time.
I'm playing the chief of police.
First time a black chief of police on television.
First time a black chief of police on television.
And this is what year? 1968.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now I couldn't tell you about what those people were like then because I was just a kid. I mean, they gave me a first class ticket. Still had propeller airplanes.
And you'd had some heat on Broadway, we should mention.
I had a great agent and the head of the Universal, Lou Wasserman. And they sent for me, and I was first class, and the limousine came out to the plane. And everybody said, "Why, yo, what is this guy?" You know, and I get in the car. They take me to the Beverly Hills Hotel. They put me in a presidential cottage. And my feet were not touching the ground. Oh, I said, wow, you know, and I got the flowers from my agent, Ed Bondi, who I mentioned when I got the Oscar, and Lou Wasserman, who created the Universal. So now I get a note, your rental car is ready for you. If you've been in Los Angeles, Hearst Rent-A-Car is on Sunset Boulevard, some 25 minutes away from the hotel. Mm-hmm. And so I get left to the Hearst Rent-A-Car, and Sunset Boulevard, hot sun and stuff. And they give me a Ford Fairlane Galaxy 500.
Oh, 1968 Fairlane.
Yeah. All white on the outside and all red in the interior. And I put the top down. And my favorite singer was Sam Cooke.
Yes.
So I had Sam Cooke on there. Singing and stuff. It took me 4.5 hours to get from Sunset and Crescent Heights to the Beverly Hills Hotel.
4.5 hours for a 25-minute ride. Tell the audience why. Tell them why.
And I stopped. Every policeman saw me. I answered to the description. And I stopped for 15, 20 minutes with each one. I met each one all the way down Sunset Boulevard. And finally, it started getting funny after a while. After about the 15th one, I said, "I know I answered the description." They said, "What? You have some advice. Put your top up and turn your radio down and be quiet." So I put the top up, turned the radio down, went to the Beverly Hills Hotel. And then the man in the Beverly Hills Hotel was very nice. He explained, "You just can't do that here." Not, very much like the film L.A. Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
That's how L.A. was. So I'm going to forget it. And I go down and I get this prime rib in the restaurant in the hotel with the Yorkshire pudding, you know, and a baked potato with the sour cream. I'm having a ball. And I'm having a strawberry shortcake, and I got a good old-fashioned New York milkshake. But I can't go to sleep. I'm just like this, so I'm going to go walk and see the movie stars' homes.
In Beverly Hills.
In Beverly Hills.
A black man in 1968.
Yeah, right. So I went and said, "Oh, there's Clark Gable over there. Oh, yeah. Hi, Lou. Yeah, I answered the description, don't I, right?" So they wound up handcuffing me to a tree for 3 hours as a lesson not to walk at Beverly Hills after 9. It's still on the dockets, but they have their... So now I'm getting a little upset, you know. I got to go to the bathroom, and I can't. I eventually did. And they were going by and forth and throwing beer cans. So finally, when they let me go back to the hotel, and the doorman saw me, and he said, "What happened?" I told him. And then I went to the house and went to their place and took a shower and controlled myself and called my mother and father. And my father said, "You stay right there. I'll be there." I said, "Man, you're in New York and I'm in Los Angeles. You're going to drive." And my mother said, "You come back right away." And I thought about it. The next morning, I was supposed to go to work at the Universal. And I told my agent, too, I didn't have his night number. And he says, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm here. I may as well go to work." He says, "That's what I expected you to say." So I get in the car and go to work. And it took me 15 to 20 minutes to get into the Universal because they did not believe that I had a lead in a show that had Gig Young, Donna Winter, William Redfield, Donna Winter, Ann Baxter, Melvin Douglas, and me. Finally came down.
And the guard didn't buy it. The guard did not buy it.
No, he didn't buy it. He didn't. He said, "What are they doing up there?" So finally they gave me, he said, "I guess I'm going to have to give you this. This is your parking spot. Who are you anyway?" But it just didn't register. So I get on the stage and I do it. Gig Young got an Emmy for that called Companions of Nightmare about a psych unit. And Melvin Douglas was a doctor. And one of those people in that psych unit, what do they call it, that kind of therapy, group therapy, mm-hmm. was a killer. It turned out to be Gig Young. He won the first Emmy. And then Norman Lloyd, thank God. And I just thank you. Because then I was set up to integrate the rest of television. I did Petrocelli with Barry Newman playing the district attorney. But up until that time, none of us were played anything of judges and chiefs of police. We started a nice trend in television. And then eventually we started to get into to feature films. Sidney Poitier was my forerunner. That's my hero.
And you were in A Raisin in the Sun.
We were in A Raisin in the Sun together.
That was your first film, right?
That was my first film. No, that was not my first film.
That wasn't your first film.
First big film was A Raisin in the Sun. Yeah, that was my first film.
How do you forget A Raisin in the Sun is your first film?
No, I just remember. Yeah, you know, it's the first film. The second one was a thing called The Bush Baby. The first big film that I had a lead in, you know. And we were in Kenya and Tanzania and Africa. And I played an African. And there was also the year of the first national television for those countries. Those people had not seen. They only saw movies. Mm-hmm. Now, this is national television. And I just finished doing an episode of The Nurses with Zita Bethune. They had Goodyear. They had the East Side, West Side at the time and Judd for the Defense. Great television series. The Defenders and The Nurses. And I played this kind of kid who was crazy, and he'd gotten shot. And he'd be befriended by Zita Bethune, the nurse. And I just couldn't handle it. I tried to escape, and I ripped my wounds, and I die. And it was quite dramatic, you know. So I'm doing it up as an actor. So now I get on the plane, and I end up in Nairobi, and people are looking at me. So I get to the Nairobi Hilton, and they're coming in and grabbing my shirt and opening it up and says, "How did you do that?" They had not seen the movie before. They had not seen, so they went, and I had to walk around all of Nairobi with my shirt open. He came back to life.
I was up one night about two or three months ago, and I was flipping channels in the middle of the night, and I came across The Partridge Family. Mm. And there's an episode with you and Richard Pryor on The Partridge Family.
Absolutely.
And I think, what are you and Richard Pryor doing on The Partridge Family?
Well, we had a place. I was as a result of all the fires, you know, in Detroit. And then we were at peace. Then we have this disco called The Firehouse, and we ordered The Temptations to come. And the booking thing got crisscrossed. And the Partridge Family showed up.
And the audience was just as happy, I'm sure.
I was just as happy, right. But that was a lot of fun. That was a great deal. I missed that man. There was a special about Richard Pryor, and he was so far ahead of his time.
That was brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
What was he like as a human being?
He was a genius, and genius is sometimes not all there. But he's there on another level. He's absolutely way ahead of his time. Absolute genius. I think sometimes the geniuses live a short time. And then just either I separate them from the medias and the comets. Mm-hmm. And he was a media, like Janis Joplin, and the kid from The Doors, and people like that, Tim Harden, James Dean. They all kind of flash through, and then they make their mark and they're gone. Whereas the comets, like the Bob Dylans and those particular kind of people, come back again and again and again. So I prayed to be a comet. So here I am after 60 years still doing it. But I never forget those Jimi Hendrix people because I grew up with them. Mm-hmm. And the Jimmy Deans and the Bob Dylans. And they leave a lasting impression in my life.
There's a great picture in the book of you with Richard Pryor and with Cassius Clay.
Cassius Clay. Okay. He was Cassius Clay at the time.
He was Cassius Clay at the time.
The other guy was Roger Mosley, the helicopter pilot from Magnum. Yeah. But the one story I wanted to tell you, which you wouldn't have known about, so I'll tell you about. In Africa, it was directed by a crazy director by the name of John Trent, God rest his soul, because he got crazy, really crazy. And I'm playing a houseboy, but the country is about to go through the transition from going a colony to independent. And there are elements there that don't like that. The little girl, I watched her being born in Africa, and she had a pet called a bush baby. It's a pet. It's a galago. It looks like a combination of a squirrel and a monkey. They sleep in their tails, and you get them by putting palm beer on, and they get drunk, and they fall down. Uh-oh, here comes a note. It says, get out. That's what it says. But to make a long story short, they paid everybody to find me and a little girl, and they're trying to chase me. They're going to kill me. So there's a scene with me and a pygmy. And the pygmy, at the time, were the poachers. And they would poach an elephant with a small arrow and a bow and arrow with poison at the end. They had maybe about this square behind the ears to get the elephant, and they never miss. Right? So in the scene, I've got to approach this pygmy, and we have to fight, and the pygmy runs away. So they got a real pygmy.
A real pygmy.
I got a real pygmy. He's sitting there. You don't know about no movies. So there's the director. There's me. There's the translator from English to Swahili. And then another guy from Swahili to the pygmy language. The director says, here's what we're going to do. Mr. Gossett is in the clearing, and he sees you. And he's going to go over, and he's going to grab you before you pick up your bow and arrow. You throw the bow and arrow away. And you're going to go over, and you're going to come in with a knife, and he's going to grab the knife and throw the knife away, and you're going to get out of the way and run away. So the guy says, okay. So then the guy from Swahili's got to talk to the pygmy, and he says, you want me to tell him that? So he says, okay. And so the pygmy's looking at him with a straight face. He says, And the pygmy said, ah! He said, no way. No way, right? So the director says, well, Mr. Gossett is an athlete. We got to have this scene. So we're going to have you over there about 20 feet away. I'm going to take your bow and arrow and put it over here and your knife over there. And when I say go, he's going to grab it and see if he can do it. So pygmy says, cool, you know. They said, go. And before I took my first step, the pygmy had in my nose. And it was a long pause and he went, ah, I told you, he was the hero of Nairobi. Until every day I come out of the hotel, he was across the street with more people. By the time I left, he had a crowd. That was my first time. If he had let that arrow go, I would be here talking to you.
Wouldn't be standing here today.
Poison on the end of it, yeah.
Well, the anniversary edition of Roots just came out. I saw the book, actually, 30th anniversary edition, I believe.
Yeah,
or 40th anniversary edition of the book just came out. I saw the miniseries, as did the rest of America.
Yeah.
And what was really great about it, I was like 12 years old, is that, you know, I didn't realize as a young African-American boy that we had a history. I didn't realize that we had a history before Roots. Tell me, if you realize, as well as the other actors in that miniseries, the impact that it was going to have on the nation and the rest of the world, or was it just a job?
It was more than a job. It was very special for us to do well, all of us. But we had no idea of the impact. Neither did ABC, because they said, well, we own this contract to David Walker, so what we're going to do is we're going to put it together for 7 straight days, one after another. Then we get rid of it. How little did they realize?
In January. It was in January,
yeah, in
right?
January, and the entire world stopped to watch it. And it's important, you know, for us to know where we come from, all of us. I know all about my white friends. I know all about Napoleon. I know about, King Arthur. I know about the Vikings. I know about the Roman Empire and the Greeks and the Sicilians. I know all about that. I learned it in school. I know about the films. So that when I came west with my contemporaries was the Anthony Quinns and the Steve McQueens and the Paul Newmans and the Ben Gazzaras and the Anthony Franciosas, all my good friends. And they got a chance to play those parts. My mouth waters. I figured once I win an Oscar, I'd be able to play maybe Kwame Nkrumah or maybe the chief of the Ashanti Empire or maybe some of the great cowboys. And I was not allowed to. So it was a kind of a bitter resentment in a sense. And resentment is not good for anybody, but I was frustrated not being able to call a shot. If I was frustrated, I imagine what our children see when they don't see themselves or their history on the screen, which is where my foundation once again comes in. This is where you come from. This is upon whose shoulders you stand. And when the child has that information, their choices are different because they're going to sit at the table of diversity in here in this country eventually, and they have to know where they come from so they can know where they're going. The doors are open of opportunity, but they're afraid to leave their subculture, which they're very comfortable with, and go through that door of opportunity like our president does. And they need to be encouraged with love, all children, to practice how this country should be. And if you practice that way as a child, each one teach one, so that if you're 7, you learn certain kind of things, and when you're 9, you teach the 7, and when you're 11, you teach the 7 and the 5, and when you're 15, you teach the 10, the 9, and the 7. By the time you get to policy-making areas, you have a built-in habit. And the least thing that gets in the way is racism is gone. So if we are one nation, eventually, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, the least or the most we should do is to get to that plateau so we can start the common American culture. It's almost like a cancer now. It might have been good before, but this is another day today. We're moving quite fast, and we really need one another to be together to make the country great, but also to save this planet.
All right, you mentioned being bitter about the roles that you weren't able to get after winning your Oscar. Let's talk about An Officer and a Gentleman. We've all seen An Officer and a Gentleman here, haven't we? Yes, one of the greatest movies ever.
Get down, give me 50.
Actually, you trained. You actually went through basic training.
I went to San Diego for 30 days and became a DI.
Well, what'd they have you do? And could you keep up with those guys?
I did everything, but I almost died, but I didn't. And then I did everything but drink the beer and smoke the camels. But there's a the Marine DI is a very special human being. Loaded with love and respect. He's got to tear you down and build you back up as a man. And they did that to me, and then I did that to others, and I came as a DI. I wasn't acting at all. I knew how to do that.
You separated yourself from the other actors, right?
Because they were laughing at me. You know, I'd go in, and they'd giggle and say, "I got you." So I moved away and never saw them. When I showed up, I was that DI, and the word went back to Hollywood that I was up there losing my mind. But I got the right results.
Now, seeing that movie at the time, the thing that was really the most jarring, anyway, for me, was the fight scene that you had with Richard Gere, because you did not see, first of all, you didn't see African-American men in positions of authority. Mm-hmm. But secondly, you certainly did not see an African-American man beating up on Richard Gere. That just didn't happen.
I still pay for that today. I don't go to bars because everyone wants to check me out. But
are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. Yeah, and then
they want to fight.
They want to check me out. But that's 30 years ago, man. You know, I have to go get a gun now. Instead of wheeling.
He was very gracious in terms of that.
He was wonderful. My hat goes off to him. But he did say at one time, "I'm the star of the show. I got to win the fight." And the Marine said, "Oh, no, you ain't." And they said, "If you let that man win the fight, we're gonna tear this place apart." That's what the Marines said.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They have a lot of pride. So, and then they said, they saw me fight, and I had to requalify for my second degree black belt in Taekwondo. And Richard did the street karate, where you jump up and down. So you have to do is catch him when his feet are off the ground, and it's over. So, but Taylor said, "No, let's continue to stage this." And we did it all. Took over 3 days. I had a slight hairline fracture when he slept, and he had a slight miss thing on his shoulder where I slept. But we did it. It was all us.
Now, you told me before when you won the Academy Award, you were really surprised. You didn't have the speech. You didn't think you were going to win.
I don't know. But over to my left was James Mason, The Verdict. That was his last movie. And over to the right was Robert, what's his name? I've forgotten his name, from Victoria. And it was his last
Preston. Movie. Preston. Preston, yeah.
And I said, "I'm glad to be at one of the top five. So I think I'm going to just be cool." My son was here. My agent was there. And I kind of... maybe not go to sleep, but I went to kind of repose. And my agent hit me on the chest and said, "Just said your name." I said, "No." He said, "Look, I said your name." I got up and I said, "Now what am I going to say?" I got a kiss from Susan Sarandon and shook Christopher Reeve's hand. And I behaved like he was Superman. So I said, my hand hurt after I shook it. And I got up there and I talked to my grandmother. And I talked to my parents. And then my agent. And then I said, "For the rest of you guys, this is ours and split." And I thought then was, wow, I'm here. I'm here with the guys that I came west with, you know, Paul Newman and Brando and Anthony Quinn. And I see what they do. Boy, if I get half of that stuff, wow. So I got to my agent, and my agent says, "Not yet." I said, "No, I want to play Kwame Nkrumah. I want to play Jomo Kenyatta. I want to play Bill Pickett." Martin Delaney, Frederick Douglass, and I was not able to. But the best I got was I had to be, they said it wouldn't sell. And I think that was not true, and I got quite bitter. And so I did, never got the money. I never got $1 million for any of the movies.
You never got $1 million?
Never. 78 movies. But Chuck Norris got $1 million. Dennis Quaid got $1 million. And James Woods got $1 million. And Dolph Lundgren got $1 million. You got the big dressing rooms and the big buses, and I got the small ones. It began to work on me, and I began to get bitter, thinking that maybe I should have been that doctor that I promised myself to be. And I was stuck. How much further can you go, and what else do you have to prove? And I did. Somebody walked in the house with drugs, and I took it. But shortly after that, I realized that that wasn't the way, because then that's self-destructive. I learned that from Dr. Mandela. But I was in Africa doing a movie, and I was sat at the corner at the point called Landudno, looking at the combination when the Atlantic Ocean meets the Indian Ocean, and there was Robben Island. And I reflected on what had happened to him. And I realized that I was doing more to myself than anybody had done to me. And he had suffered all of that stuff, the main part of his life, and it came out the way he came out. So I became quite small and right-sized. And from then on, I've been straight. He had a choice. He had a choice of coming out and saying, kill everybody! Or he came out this way. And as a result, the results are still happening. The World Cup was wonderful. But it happened because he came out of Robben Island the way he came out. So he's my hero. He's my role model. And I need to tell that to all the young, that what's happening here may not always be the answer. We need something stronger than us to give us some advice. You might call him God. You might call him Krishna. You might call him Allah. It doesn't matter. But there's a prophecy, and there's a thing that we need, all of us, I believe. And I can't tell you what to do. I really can't tell you what to do. But I found out by observation that we must be motivated by something highly spiritual that motivates us to do the right thing. We have to do inventory on a daily basis. That's what I have to do. And make sure it's never going to be perfect, and we're never going to achieve it. And the just desserts is not the accomplishment of the level, but the journey to that place is where life is at its best. It's not what I accumulate, but what I donate to others. And when the tide comes back, it's a cornucopia of good stuff. That's what's happening in my life, and others that I respect. So by suggestion, I put it in the book. That's another reason why I have the foundation.
I should mention the book again, An Actor and a Gentleman. And we've got some questions from folks in the audience.
Go ahead.
Here.
Yeah.
Here's one. Says, I have the playbill from A Raisin in the Sun, 1960. Uh-oh. And you were listed as Louis Gossett. When did you start using Louis Gossett Jr.?
I started using Louis Gossett Jr. during Roots to give my father the tribute that he deserved, because he worked very hard to keep me from the streets and to keep me in clothes. And I was growing very fast, and he worked very hard. So I gave them the tribute to reconnect the generation. We need to reconnect our generation, all of us. I see a mother and a daughter there. Right? Oh, niece, that's okay. But that's what, that's the good stuff. That's the good stuff, yeah.
Here's the next one. It says, what is being done to reduce racism in Hollywood, or do you think that things are going well as far as Hollywood's concerned?
Things are going well, but there's a last minute thing happening, especially this year in the Emmys. We call it the Vemmys this year. But it's tough. It's a psychological...
Is it really still tough? Because I look at shows like Grey's Anatomy,
for example. There's more, but then there's that last mountain. And it always happens that way. It always gets hard before it gets better. And it's going to get better very quickly.
Well, I remember in the 80s you did a series called Gideon Oliver.
Oh, yeah.
They got great reviews, yeah. And they said at the time
that
when that show came on, it was like there was a power failure below the Mason-Dixon line.
It was not true.
And I know what I'm saying, but that's what they were saying. They said it was like that was quote-unquote proof that an African-American couldn't be the lead in a one-hour television drama.
No, that's not true. It's got to change. And it will. And it will. But the other thing I've learned is it doesn't. That came from Alex Haley's art too, when she said God may not be there when you want him, but he's always there on time.
Speaking of Alex Haley, here's a question that says, in regard to Roots, did you get a chance to have a meaningful conversation with Alex Haley?
Oh, that was my best friend. We used to speak after Roots. I won the Emmy, and he wrote it. And we meet each other in airports with our feet hurting. He'd go one way, and I'd go another, speaking and speaking. And the thing about Roots, if you've seen Roots, when my best friend was the late guy that whipped Kunta Kinte.
Vic Morrow, right?
Yeah. He was in combat, if you remember. And he said, I'm sorry. He apologized before he did it, but I got to do this for Three Dimensions. And I said, go for it. And he really got my ire up because he did it very good. I mean, Kunta Kinte did his thing very good. I'm sitting there watching, and it was only felt and makeup on the back, but it was so real that I got very emotional. And my last line in the script was, what you care what the white man call you, Toby, no matter. Kunta Kinte, that's what your name is. That's who you'll always be. That's the end of the script, and it was going to go to commercial. But instead of stopping, I don't know where it came from, and I said, there's going to be a better day. There's going to be another day. Do you hear me? There's going to be another day. And that came out of me, and I don't remember saying it. But I saw it, and I said, wow, I did say that. So Alex told me, and he spoke, when he spoke, he told me about those extra lines. But it was a very emotional scene, and it's in Roots today.
Well, LeVar Burton was an unknown at the time.
Yeah,
he was cast
out
in
of SC. Yeah.
What was he like to work with?
Oh, he's just like Kunta Kinte.
Like him running away? What?
I mean, he was trying to run. No, not trying to run away, but he was very much knew that was his shot. And then he did it 360, 100%. 100% Kunta. Him and John Amos. I enjoyed working with those people. Great experience.
Let's see. Lots of questions here about Roots. Oh, here's one. Okay, you mentioned your... you mentioned moving your activism to the universities. Would you please speak on that? You've got a professorship you've been offered.
I have a professorship that has been offered. I've got a lot of resident professorships from Bethune-Cookman and Spelman and now Howard and a couple of places. But I've been offered a professorship at Savannah State. Savannah State is a combination of a lot of things. It's that's where the Civil War started. That's where it ended. It's a beautiful place. But they've got a couple of agencies there. They've got Savannah State teachers. They've got the Y, which is very, very important in the town. And they've got Harambee House, which is an African heritage house. They've got the Gullahs, what's the pure African from the islands. They've got the mayor's section. Then they've got this one woman here. And they have this Savannah Council on the Arts. But according to all of these, and this one woman who has all of the theaters, they kind of control Savannah, and it being so beautiful. Once again, I said, I can't come unless I can represent all of you. One woman who owns the property, she's the descendant of the Daughters of the American Revolution. And they say she's a little difficult, but I want to be in a room with her one-on-one, and I have the feeling that she'll relinquish some of the control so that we can have probably one of the greatest film and art festivals in the United States by inviting the films from Europe and the Caribbean and Africa, just like Sundance, some combination of Sundance and Cannes, so they can see music, dance, art, theater, and film for a 10, 15-day thing. It would take Savannah to put it on the map once a year, but then we'd give awards and scholarships to those particular people, so Savannah could be as gorgeous as it is. She needs to get into the 21st century, and that would help for those people to come and there. It would be great financially for the city. But once a year, you can look forward to seeing the best in one place. And hopefully they'll go for that. I have a feeling they will. That's the only way I could be a professor there. That would only be from the 2nd to the 8th. Yes.
Here's an interesting one. Here's something I had not heard. You know, there's so many rumors and myths that go around. So tell me if this is true. Did you really turn down an opportunity to do a love scene with Marilyn Monroe?
Oh, I figured you'd get to that. Oh, man.
This is from the audience, not from me.
Yeah, that's from the audience. Well, there's no way. I was full of juice at that age. You know, I was like that, you know, doing the Lee Strasberg Theater. And so we're studying, and Marilyn Monroe was married to Arthur Miller. And she showed up. She could have been quite an actress. If she was alive and still stuck with Arthur Miller, she'd probably have quite a few Oscars and a couple of Emmys by now. She was getting really good. And for some reason, she sat close to me like this. And her husband had Lifebuoy soap. You remember how Lifebuoy soap used to smell? She would come in, I'd spill the Lifebuoy soap before she got there. And all my stuff started going. I couldn't speak. And she'd have the cut off of the shirt to the flip-flops to the jeans. And she'd go, hi, Lou. And sure, I just thought she was one of those people. If you men must have had at least one woman in your life that you couldn't be that close to. Marilyn was for money, for me. And I'd say, here come the Life Boy soap. And involuntarily, I had to leave alive. And so now I'm living in the Lower East Side, and the phone rings. I say, hello. And they hear on the other side, hello, Lewis. I said, yeah. This is Marilyn. I said, Marilyn who? Marilyn from class. Marilyn from class. Oh, God. Here I go. I would like for you to do the love scene for the rose tattoo with me. Hello, Lewis. Lewis, are you there? Yeah, I'm there, but I don't think there's any way I could get up there. Not one word would have come out. And then I have to wind up kissing her? No. No, that's not so. I think Marty Landau, who was in that class, or one of those people, did the scene. It was about a frustrated thing because you wanted they just couldn't. People were watching them. If you know the kid for the rose tattoo, there was no way in the world at that age and at that time of my life could I do a love scene with Marilyn Monroe. Not only was I be looking over my shoulder, but I just couldn't do it. Diana Sands was another idea, though. That's my baby. The scenes with Cicely and Diana and all those particular people. But not Marilyn Monroe.
Is there any role that you look back on now that you turned down or that you couldn't do and you really wish you had taken it?
Oh, boy, there's a lot. But the agents, the managers, mm-hmm. So you weren't getting enough money. I said, let me make that decision.
Give me an example.
The Soldier Story.
Really?
Yep. But Hal Rollins played that character because it's so military, and they turned it down for me. Wasn't making a lot of money. Shawshank Redemption.
Morgan's part?
Morgan's part. And a couple of others like that because they weren't making their money. And then, of course, when I fired them, I didn't work in the town. So it was a rockin' hard place. So I got a little bit hard.
Is it true that you were originally cast to play Gale Sayers in Brian's song?
Yeah, well, I was going to play Gale Sayers in Brian's song, and I went out to work out, and I got an Achilles tendon injury. Yeah, but I don't regret any other parts that I've played. I really wish I'd done that.
I've been playing
since I was in a blacklist or whatever. Some of those parts that I see Morgan and Sammy Jackson doing probably were mine. They told Samuel, shave your head and put an earring in your ear. I know this one obviously is going to be my part. Anyway, he's over there. I'm over here talking to you.
What do you like to watch today in terms of television and film? Let's say television. If there were any show right now that you could be a part of, what do you find interesting on TV? What would you like? What do you watch? What would you like to do right now?
There's a series. I like Westerns. I like Westerns, but the Westerns have not been true. With the knowledge when you win Oscars and Emmys and stuff, you do your research, and that's how I got into this. We have such an incredible Western history, and nobody knows about them. I was sitting there. I wish I had... if Bobby Angel has it... No, it's packed away. Do you have that Western book, Bobby Angel? Can you hear me?
No, sir, I do not.
You know, that's him. That's the villain of the piece. Anyway, I'm sitting there backstage on the street doing Daddy's Little Girls in Atlanta. And these young kids were around, kind of tough, you know. They thought they were tough. Pants down, halfway down, and they got their hats all fine. So they come to me, and they knew who I was from the movies. And they said, what are you reading? I took the book, and I hid it. And I said, well, you know about Wyatt Earp? And they said, yes, we know all about Wyatt Earp. Wyatt Earp was done by Kurt Kastner, Kevin Kastner and Costner, and Kurt Russell. And they had a great black outfit, you know, and they killed the Klans. I said, that's good. Well, let me tell you a story. Wyatt Earp was hired by Judge Parker after the war to tame the territory so that the people could come out and live peacefully. They must have hired 15 or 20 of the great marshals of that time. There was Wild Bill Hickok and Bat Masterson and all those particular people. But the most successful marshal in the West that got the book out, it looked like this. Big guy with a big handlebar mustache by the name of Bass Reeves. The most successful marshal in the West, in which there had not been any movies, was Bass Reeves. His career went in 36 years, and he had to go and get his son. The kid said, no. I said, yeah, there it is. There's the book. So Tyler says, we need you in the scene, Mr. Gossett. So I get up and I put the book in the chair. And I go and do the scene. And I come back, and the assistant director says, I'm sorry to tell you, but the kid stole your book. I said, yeah, I know. So I could see those kids, those crazy kids, with a flashlight somewhere, looking at this So there's a curiosity, even in the tough ones. If you give them enough attention, most of them respond. Some of them you can't, but most of them you can save. Most of them.
Your career has spanned the time from early TV, the golden age of television, then radio, and the explosion of all the electronic communication entertainment. What advice would you give to a young person today who aspires to be a successful actor or performer in any form of media?
I'll tell any kid today that there is no such thing as impossible. There's many ways to make it and do things as there are people. This is the beginning. It's opening. We got miraculously, in my lifetime, which I never thought would happen, we have the first president of the United States that looks like me. Kind of halfway. He's half and half. He fits like a glove, doesn't he? He's new. He's not done any of his programs quite as yet. He's still cleaning up a mess. But for some reason, this is his 4 years to try and change a pattern. He's not going to be perfect. Nothing is perfect. But I like his intention and his heart and his roots from where he comes from. I'm going to help to put him in there. And I'm not shy. I'm not sorry. I hope to see him and his wife when I go to Washington tonight. I'm going to the Urban League convention, and hopefully I'll get to see at least Michelle, who loves children as much as I do. But I love them. I love them very dearly. I think they're decent people, and I think they should be given a chance to put their programs in action.
Absolutely. So another audience question. Tell us about working on Stargate.
Stargate, well, that was a piece of cake. That was wonderful. But it was the bad part. It was just the last 5 episodes of the series. I wouldn't mind going up there now. Vancouver, which is a wonderful place, full of the people who ran from Hong Kong. So, you know, the food was incredible. The fresh air, the fish. A beautiful city, Vancouver. And I wouldn't mind doing that for years. It was a great, great character. You know, and some very nice people. That show had been on so long that there were marriages and divorces and births and stuff. And so it was really very nice working with those people.
Do you like science fiction?
I love science fiction.
I loved you in the movie Enemy Mine, where you were the first. You hold the distinction of being the first male to give birth on screen.
Yeah.
That's true. You ever seen the movie Enemy Mine?
And women asked me, how did it feel? I said, you know how I feel. You know? But there's a story about that. Enemy Mine, you know, if people who did not see it, I'm full of lizard skin from head to toe. And the first time we had one director, his name is Richard Longcrane, and he had me have makeup from head to toe, and it took 8 hours. So you get in a barber chair and you go to sleep, you wake up like a lizard. So after about the fifth day, I'm getting a little rash. So I said, now we're going to have 6 months of shoot, and I better get some ointment. Now we're on this island in Iceland, where the volcano exploded. So that's just called Jaime. And there's no skin doctor in Jaime in Iceland. And they had to search back to Reykjavik to see if in the med school was there a skin doctor. So I got this sophomore kid. She's about 5'4", scared to death. I didn't tell her anything. So I see her coming up the mountain in the snow and stuff, nervous with a little purse and a little medicine camp. I didn't tell her anything. So I sit her down, and I come out and I say, hi, doc, I'm the one with the skin problem. I'm full of lizard skin, right? And they had to catch her. Since she had a little tube, I can't do anything with that. Oh, it was she freaked. What did she freak? They had to pull her back, dragging. I was just. So finally she gave me the stuff and I opened up. She says, oh, there's a black man in there too. That was a funny time.
Someone in the audience would like to know, would like you to talk about your role as Anwar Sadat.
Oh boy, that was a very special time. I remember Anwar Sadat, he was a man of peace, and him and Barbara had a wonderful thing, and him and Walter Cronkite. There was very little, but I loved him because of his wanting to make peace. Where there was war, and he did the transition during his life when he was a soldier, and then he became, when he lost his brother and all that. So it was a great arc for an actor to play, and for me to play the part being chosen by his wife, and because Sadat had collected all movies, including Roots, and she remembered me in Roots, and I wanted, she said, how about that gossip fellow? So Jihan chose me to play her husband. So That was a very blessed time. And I wound up playing Sadat. And everybody had boycotted because they said that's not the way it went. But it was in everybody's home. And so both Israel and Egypt knew that I played Sadat. And I scuba dive a lot. So I got to go to Israel and to Egypt without a passport. And they fight. He's going to be in my car. No, he's going to be in my car. So I still go there. I've been to Israel 7 times because I played Sadat. Everybody unconditionally says, "You're Sadat." They call me Sadat, Sadat. It was very nice. It's a very nice experience.
Is there a character that people will shout out or will call you when you're walking around in the United States?
The United States, yeah, the Marine. Yeah, the Marine.
Hey, Foley.
Foley, yeah. I guess the Marine, yeah. But in Israel and Egypt, it's Sadat.
Yeah. Let's see, here's another one. There have been changes in school curriculums for history and in some states. A revisionist history is being explored. How important is it to teach our children an accurate account of U.S. history that includes some painful lessons like that of slavery?
Oh, boy, it's so extremely important. I think the biggest mistake we did in our educational system is taking the history, the entertainment out of it, the curriculum of the films and the history and the documents because of the budget. I think that's what kids learn. A personal experience is one of my best friends was the late George C. Scott, who did Patton. Now, I had 4 uncles on each side of my family who went to World War II. Two of them were in the Red Ball Express. And I'll explain, if you want me to, I'll explain the history. After seeing Patton, myself and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar were MCs in Lincoln Center. Oh, maybe it's about 15 years ago now. His name was Lou Alcindor at the time. And we were the hosts of the reunion between those tank battalions of the Black Tank 761st Regiment Armory and those Jews that they rescued. And they were Patton's tanks. Now, the story starts with Mary McLeod Bethune, who was Eleanor Roosevelt's best friend. She put a plant in Eleanor's head. Eleanor went to her husband and said, "Well, you must integrate the armed forces. Take those African-American boys and give them weapons and start the tanks and put them in training and put them into the war. It's their country too." So the 761st, there was another tank battalion, were this crack tank battalions, and then the FDR called Eisenhower and said, "You have to take them." He says, "Wow, well, we don't want them. They can't fight. I'll tell you what, I'm going to call Patton because he don't like them either. And they took them to North Africa where the Field Marshal Rommel had cornered the British. They were about to annihilate the British. And they sent these tanks to North Africa. This is true. Went to to North Africa, and with them, along with the Tuskegee Airmen, who flew low enough to figure out what Field Marshal Rommel was doing, they defeated Field Marshal Rommel's tank battalion, and they left and went back to Berlin. So that didn't work. So they took them and put them against the Panzer Division, which is the best tank division in the history of war. And the road toward Berlin. And they wound up cutting up a cut between the Panzer Division on one side or the other. And they ran out of gas. And they radioed back to headquarters for 75 tankers full of gasoline to refuel the tanks. 63 of them made it. It was called the Red Ball Express. And there's been many movies about the Red Ball Express. And they went 100 miles an hour, bumper to bumper. 63 of them made it. They refueled the tanks. And they beat the Panzers on both sides. They crossed the river and broke the walls down in Buchenwald, Auschwitz, and Dachau. And me and Kareem, were at the reunion of those 2 soldiers and those refugees, the tearful reunion. Now, George C. Scott came and said, "What's this?" And I said, "That's the Patton thing." And George C. Scott took his Oscar and gave it back to the Academy because they had not told the truth. Now, that's one story.
Wow.
There are hundreds of stories like
that.
He gave
it back to the Academy.
He said, I can't do it because we didn't do the proper story. How wonderful that movie. It was a great movie. But how wonderful would it have been had they done the full wonderful story? And so there's a documentary called The Liberators. You can get it on your computer and see the same story. Now, we can still have to do that story. But then there's other stories. Searching for Private Ryan. I had 2 uncles there. Another story, MacArthur, Flag for Our Fathers. So the damage is done to our children who don't think that we even went to the war. And they opt for other things. We need to feed them, all children, with just the truth. If you can do something that's basically, the truth is so essential to our children. And when they grow up and they can talk to each other and live with one another, that stuff will go away. But we need all children to be serviced properly with their history so they know upon whose shoulders they stand. It's extremely important.
Now, I'll kind of piggybacking on that same topic.
Yeah.
Someone asked, speaking to parents and educators, what is the message you would like to get young kids to, you would like to give to young kids to encourage them to live a life free of racism and violence? And this will be the last question.
Practice it as a child and don't practice it as a grown up. You practice living free of it as a child. It won't reoccur.
So you practice living free of it. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, there are exercises in my curriculum that get them to practice games and certain things and contests and certain experiences together, whether it's dance or rubber ball or basketball. It's happening in sports already. But to give them those exercises and an environment where there's no difference, the children don't learn that. They just grow up wonderfully. I grew up with a whole bunch of people who are still alive, who are still my friends today. And we owe that to ourselves so that we can become one nation under God with liberty and justice. For who?
Louis Gossett Jr., the book, once again, it's An Actor and a Gentleman, and it is a great, great read. So I want to encourage you to pick it up and to read it if you haven't. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and you'll come away inspired. It's been just a pleasure to sit with you. Louis Gossett.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and San Jose Repertory Theater. Again, we would like to thank Louis Gossett Jr., author of An Actor and a Gentleman, Brian Copeland, KGO radio host and author of Not a Genuine Black Man, our audience here in San Jose, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting is adjourned.